May it please the court, Jeff Hawks here, registration number 23500, but I am appearing pro se. This case really boils down to one simple question, the answer to one simple question. And that question is, if one reads the January 25th, 2013 complaint, does one understand that the plaintiff, referring to myself in the third person, was appealing the decision of the Planning Commission? And I don't think there's any doubt that the answer to that question has to be yes. So that brings us to, there was a 106A4 claim made. There were ample statements of fact to put the defendants on notice of the transaction or occurrences giving rise to the claim. The complaint plainly stated the relief sought. And that's really, I believe, the end of this.
Well, can I ask you a question about the relief sought? Because the original complaint was seeking relief in the nature of mandamus against the administrator and then other defendants for other grounds. So there was not any claim sought under 106A4. Is that accurate?
There is no explicit citation to 106A4, Your Honor, but the record was certified. There's a reference in the complaint, paragraph 27, that the record will be certified and submitted to the trial court.
But Mr. Oxyar, was the record actually certified?
It never was because we never got there.
Did you ever ask for it to be certified?
No, sir, I didn't, because we never got there. There was never an answer filed.
When you say you never got there, you could have filed the request with your original complaint, but you did not.
The rule states, sir, that the defendant could, correct, Your Honor, I could have.
I mean, the rule says explicitly if the plaintiff asks the trial court to direct the agency to issue a certified record, the court should issue such an order.
Correct, Your Honor. And there's also case law explicitly holding that the failure to request the certification is not fatal to the claim, cited in the briefs.
Thank you.
Also, within 28 days, I submitted the record after conferring with defense counsel. The reason that I did that is because the city was charging me at that point $6,460 to make this claim. I believe, I'm not a constitutional law expert by any means, but I think that's unconstitutional. It's basically a deprivation of access to the courts, or at least on attempt. That claim was settled prior to the case getting here.
All right, well, let me ask, go ahead.
Are you arguing that as long as some complaint was filed, irrespective whether it stated a claim under Rule 106, that when you then later amended it to clearly make a claim under Rule 106, that the relation back rule applies?
I'm arguing that if we got that far, that would be the rule.
What authority do you have for that?
The plain language of 106D. Rule 106 is split into two sections, 106A and 106B. And the third sentence of 106B says that if there has been a timely complaint, that one can amend and it relates back. The court did grant my amended complaint on March, that was filed on March 25th, but later did dismiss it.
But Mr. Oxyar, actually Rule 106B says the complaint may be amended to add, dismiss, or substitute parties. It doesn't say any sort of amendment, like for example, to add new claims.
Right, and the defendants made that argument. I would still go back to the long line of case law that says that you only have to state the facts and occurrences, the transaction giving rise to your claim. I did reference the Planning Commission hearing. I did reference the fact that the record was going to be certified to the trial court.
Was there any claim that there was an excess of jurisdiction or an abuse of discretion?
Your Honor, no. Those. One second. Those precise words were not used.
Okay.
But again, in the briefs, there is citation to case law that on the. Let me back up. I'm not sure that those words need to be used. I think those are ultimate facts. And CRCP 8E, I think, states that you do not have to state ultimate facts.
Okay, so as far as the notice pleading, what we have is no allegation of abuse of discretion or excess of jurisdiction, no citation to 10684. So given that, what are you setting forth to us was sufficient to give notice absent those facts?
That the Planning Commission held for the administrator, and I was seeking to have my relief. Still, I mean, just the totality of the complaint clearly states, again, you can't read the complaint and say this guy is not appealing the decision of the Planning Commission. That's clearly what I was doing. I mean, the mere existence of it.
Sorry to interrupt, but your complaint asked for relief against the administrator. It asked for no relief at all against the Planning Commission. So why should we assume you're asking for some review of the Planning Commission's decision?
I, at the risk of raising your ire, I would ask, what relief would I ask for the Planning Commission? The order that I seek is an order compelling the administrator to withdraw the permit or the CO. I'm not really coming to the court. I don't think that the trial court would order the Planning Commission to do that. It would just say the CO is revoked and the Planning Commission exceeded its jurisdiction. For that, I will stop and reserve my time. Thank you.
Okay, you have about 7 minutes and 20 seconds available.
I'm going to apologize for seeing, I'm sorry, may it please the court, Carl Hamlin, 27320. I'm going to apologize in advance for two things. One, I have a cold, so I need to stop here drinking. Two, I've just discovered I need reading glasses, and I've never done an argument with that. So if I fumble, bear with me. I think it's important, actually, I was going to open with sort of running through the briefing as it exists for the defendants. But I think I really want to open it on the admission that Ms. Grassier just made as the plaintiff in this case. I mean, there were actually broader claims to the Planning Commission underneath the January complaint. I believe that's what you just heard was his admission that what relief would he seek against the Planning Commission, and I think that's consistent with the pleadings in this case and why it's also consistent with a dismissal, consistent with the Honorable Judge Barton's ruling. That having been said, this appeal raises primarily three issues. First, the question of subject matter jurisdiction. This is not a question of statute of limitations, but rather jurisdiction in the first instance. And so either it attaches or it does not attach. But it's one of those things where it can't be told, you can't pull it along. It either attaches or it doesn't attach because it's subject matter jurisdiction. Second is the concept of relation back of both claims and parties under Rule 10684. And then third is the question of the 10682 claims or the mandamus claims.
In terms of subject matter jurisdiction, why doesn't the first claim for relief, which is the mandamus claim, why doesn't that at least vest subject matter jurisdiction?
I think there is, underneath 106A2, I believe it's possible that it may vest subject matter jurisdiction, but obviously 106A2 relates to actions and mandamus, and 106A4 relates to actions reviewing a lower tribunal for purposes of certiorari.
When you read the complaint, you get a pretty good idea. It isn't very artfully done, but did you get a pretty good idea what Mr. Utcher was complaining about?
I did. I was very clear that he was complaining about the actions of Ms. McDonald under what I took to be, while not pled as a 106A2 complaint, but as a 106A2 cause of action. Now, a 106A2 cause of action, obviously from my standpoint as a defense attorney in this case, I would look at cases such as Graham and Derby Crowley that say there are three things you need to be able to bring that mandamus claim. That the plaintiff has a clear right to the relief sought, that the defendant must have a clear duty to perform the act requested, and third, that there must be no other available remedy. Now, well, I think part of this argument is, well, shouldn't you as a competent attorney on the other side have known that I wanted to do all of these things? What was pled and what I was defending was an A2 claim which couldn't meet the three-part test of bringing a mandamus action against my client, and in fact was dismissed on those grounds. So from that standpoint, it's very distinguishable from an A6 action, or I'm sorry, an A4 action, where you're talking about reviewing the process, reviewing for arbitrary and capricious actions of a final decision-making body. In this case, Ms. McDonald, underneath the as pled, Ms. McDonald was not the final decision-maker, and in fact, we had gone to a hearing comprising 2 days and some, I think, 9 or 10 hours of work by the Planning Commission to render a final decision, which is, for purposes of this appeal, we've acknowledged is issued on January 10th, 2014. So with all of that in mind, certainly as a municipal attorney representing a quasi-judicial action, do I know that there's always the possibility that a 106 action under A4 could be brought against my client without question? It's not my responsibility to defend that every single time. That's why CRCP 8 requires that you plead with some level of particularity, particularly on jurisdictional matters, what claim you're bringing.
Well, I think that your opposing counsel and party is contending that the subject matter of what this is all about, there was notice of what the complaint is. It was the decision of the administrator in deciding not to revoke the permit, but to letting it go forward. And so that would be enough to give you notice of what the commission in upholding that either abused its discretion or exceeded its authority. What's your response to
that? Well, I honestly, because you've read the pleadings, and I know that at least one or two of you, I'm sure, or if not all of you, have reviewed the full record, you can tell that from the pleadings, it's difficult to parse that out. More importantly, from the trial judge's perspective, that is one of the notations that Judge Barton makes in his order, is that it is difficult to parse out what exactly the relief is being sought. And we'd say as to that January 25th, that the relief sought was against a city defendant. There was only one defendant, and that was Ms. McDonald. It was mandamus. So there was other relief sought against other parties. But there again, do I know that if you want to plead correctly a 106A4 action, you need to name the right parties, that you need to name the final decision-making body? Do you need to say that it has been arbitrary and capricious? Do you need to provide sufficient facts and evidence to support that? Do you need to request a certified record and have the court order the same? Yes, I know all of those things. The pleadings don't reflect any of those things.
Does the amendment provision in 106B entirely displace the general amendment provision in 15A?
I believe it does. And the reason I do is that, let me talk about that in two ways. But first is that I do think that it does because it is the Supreme Court was being more specific in 106 than it was in Rule 15, being the more general and going to the more specific. You tend in the general statutory construction to look at the more specific. And so I do think it displaces that in the sense that it is very specific about what you can amend for if you have pled a sufficient 106A4 complaint, and that you can amend for parties, and that was the change in, I believe it was 1981 by the state legislature, which I think is probably a good one, that sometimes it's hard to figure out which do you name the city of Salida, do you name the planning commission. But if you have not pled sufficiently under 106 the claim, then no, you lose your right to amend. In this case, though, if we took for argument's sake that you could amend the parties and relate back to a prior claim, you still don't have a 106 claim. So even while you could amend for those parties, you might be able to bring them in. Are any of them appropriate underneath the mandamus action? Probably not. Potentially, I suppose, the planning commission, but that time has come and passed.
So are you saying the only amendment that could be made to a 106 action is with respect to the parties, omitted or incorrectly named parties, and no other amendments are permitted by virtue of Rule 106B?
I think, unfortunately, that's very close to being the case, because 106B is very specific as to what you can amend for. And, of course, notice pleading is very broad. And so if you have pled a 106 claim, a 106A4 claim, sorry, and you have kind of hit those requirements that the case law asks you to as far as subject matter jurisdiction, I don't think you have a need to amend that claim because it's been made. And at that point, when you're reviewing the lower tribunal, there's only one final decision maker in that lower tribunal that you would be amending the party if you've already pled the claim. But that was not the case here. There was no claim pled that could be understood as being a 106A4 claim.
Mr. Hanlon, correct me if I'm wrong, but in Rule 106, is there any other time limitations on any of the claims besides A4 claims? I can see any timings in A2 or A3.
No, you see it arise, or at least I see it arise in the municipal context, oftentimes with the annexation, used in conjunction with the annexation statute, in that there is a 45-day time limit to bring an action to review that annexation proceeding, and it falls in the nature of a 106. And so that time period, 106 talks about, if not otherwise provided for, the time limit is 28 days. So I think that's where it arises, and that's why in this instance there was no other statutory time frame, nor was there another time frame provided by the city code of Salida to bring that claim, so that we're limited to 28 days.
Thank you.
We've covered a lot of this in our given case. One of the things that I would say is sort of the legal framework to rehash a little bit to try to clarify is that in a 106A4, the plaintiff bears the burden of establishing subject matter jurisdiction. It does not fall on the defendant. It doesn't fall on the trial court. It falls on the plaintiff to establish that. And that rule was laid out in Edel v. City and County of Denver by this court in 2004. So if you read that in conjunction with then the requirements of CRCP 8A, which requires if the court is of limited jurisdiction, and this is certainly an area where there is limited jurisdiction because it is being conferred specifically by the rule, that a short plain statement of the grounds that the court's jurisdiction lie, a short plain statement of claim in the demand for judgment. And as was clear from Mr. Ossier's argument here today, and as he lays it out in his briefing, he acknowledges that he didn't expressly do any of those things which are required under Rule 8. And this is a delicate thing for me, because if this were a pro se client or a pro se defendant or plaintiff who had no knowledge of the rules of civil procedure, I think in some ways my role and my responsibilities would be slightly heightened, because it is always difficult to deal with the person on the other side. I'm dealing with a licensed attorney.
So are you saying that if Mr. Oxer was not a licensed attorney, that the result that you're advocating here would be different?
No, I'm not saying that the result would be different. I'm saying that the way that the requirements of Rule 8 might be met might be less artfully done, but there certainly is knowledge in this case of what the Rule 8 requirements are and how to present those. I don't think under if even if this complaint were drafted by somebody who were not an attorney licensed by the bar, I don't think there's any way that I could get to a result that would say that a 106A4 action was properly pled. And I think in that regard, the trial court was very accurate in running through all of the factors where the complaint was defective, and that would apply regardless of who filed the complaint. I simply raise that because the pleading standards in Rule 8 are very clear. This is what you need to do, and we're all aware of that when we plead a claim. And in Judge Barton's July 3rd order, he runs through roughly 7 things to indicate why this was not a properly pled 106A4 claim. The failure to state the final decision maker and the date that the body determined that the date that was entered. There's no way for the trial court to determine jurisdiction based on the pleadings that are in front of it, the way the complaint was filed, because while the Planning Commission is mentioned, the date of the hearing, the date of the final decision was not. There's no way to establish that jurisdictional 28-day timeline that we've discussed. There is no allegation of abuse of discretion or exceeding authority, no mention of certiorari, none of those words. And more importantly, there's no description of an activity of the Planning Commission that even comes close to that standard. The argument is, well, it's implied because the Planning Commission is mentioned and I was unhappy with the outcome, that that's an abuse of discretion. I'm not sure that it's incumbent on the trial judge or the defense to make that leap of faith without that being specifically laid out. Third, the claims for declaratory relief were against other parties, and the only mention of the claim against the city defendant was the mandamus claim. The failure to name correct parties, no motion to certify the record, no clear indication of the legal basis for the claims, and try to then add claims by adding parties, which goes to this amendment issue. Those were all, perhaps one or two of those standing on their own would be fatal to this claim. Some of them maybe on their own would not be fatal to laying a claim for 106A4, but certainly the totality of the circumstances is that it was missed very broadly by being able to lay a claim for 106A4 in such a fashion that a reasonable defendant would know that that was a claim that was being brought against them. And there again, I want to distinguish that between you have to, as, and I'm going to talk a little bit about public policy, as an entity, as a reviewing lower review agency, as a municipality, you have to rely on the certainty of 106A4 in particular to know that the decisions that are being made are moving forward in a reasonable time frame and are final at some level. I could easily say, hey, for a period of, I don't know what that statute of limitations would be, every land use decision a client makes is subject to a review. So long as some claim is made against them, we may have to come back underneath Rule 106. I know that a 106 claim is always a potential, but unless it is pled, it shouldn't become a reality. It shouldn't be, the pleading standard should not be my knowledge of whether a 106 claim can be pled, but rather it should be whether or not the defendant pleads that appropriately within the time limits that are set forth. Thank you. I see it ran over by 10 seconds. I apologize for that.
No problem.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Officer, you have 7 minutes and 20 seconds left.
Thank you. As to the trial court's recitation of factors, I went through most of them in the briefings, and there's no requirement to state that you've met the statute of limitations. It's an affirmative defense. Failure to request to certify the record, there's no requirement for that. It's just when you break each of them down, they just don't stand up.
Commissioner Oxier, let me ask you about whether we should break each one of them down. The way I read the court's order was that the court wasn't saying that every one of these is essential to stating a 106A4 claim. I thought the court was saying, regardless of whether any one in particular is essential, the absence of all of them really defeats the plaintiff's claim that you gave, quote unquote, ample notice to the defendant that you were bringing a 106A4 claim.
The court's logic is that because you didn't do any of these things that the law doesn't require you to do, we're going to dismiss your case. That's...
I thought I was responding to your claim that you gave notice. And he's saying, because of the absence of all of these traditional earmarks of a 106A4 claim, you didn't give notice of a 106A4 claim.
Well, I just believe that I did, Judge. Paragraph 23 and 24 of the complaint reference the proceedings in the Planning Commission. Said the Planning Commission ruled against me. Paragraph 27 referenced that we were going to certify the record. And I think that reference, whether I certify the record or not, that is the essence of a certiorari claim.
But you never said in any words that the Planning Commission had acted improperly. I mean, I'm looking at it right now. I can't find anything where you say this Planning Commission acted unlawfully or in excess of its jurisdiction. I mean, you really have to read that in from somewhere outside of this complaint unless I'm missing something.
I guess it's not too large a leap to say that it was unlawful for the permit to be issued. Basically implies that the Planning Commission erred. And I really think that's all. I mean, that's it. And again, the reference to the record, and indeed the filing of the record within 28 days, that was a big job.
But the certified record was not filed ever, was it?
There was no certified record filed. Again, we didn't get there because of the preliminary, the motions to dismiss. I mean, we just never got there.
But the motions to dismiss came after the 28 days had elapsed since the Planning Commission's decision, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. Correct. But the record's filed. And there's a statement.
The certified record is filed?
No. The record's filed. It was filed after consultation on February 1st of 2013 with Mr. Hamlin, who said, fine, file it. And then he would have the ability to object. And we just never got there. We just never got to talking about that. And I think that's a pretty small hair to split, that particular point, but that's just okay. The way that I see it, Your Honor. Mr. Hamlin cited Eagle or Egley. That case is utterly inapposite because in that case the plaintiff had gotten a bad decision from the building official and had not appealed it within the administrative body, which was in the city of Denver. May I bring this here? The defendant talks about subject matter jurisdiction, talks about me not being a licensed attorney. I'm not a municipal attorney. I do work comp law. If Mr. Hamlin were to bring a case in work comp and I work against him, I could say the same things about him, I'm pretty sure. Not that I would. And I don't think that's at best, that's irrelevant that I'm an attorney. At worst, it's unseemly to make the argument. Again, Mr. Hamlin, or the defense, really works hard to muddy this claim. Really works hard to bring a lot of concepts in. Subject matter jurisdiction. Says I didn't meet the requirements of Rule 8. I believe that I clearly did. All to hide, really, that this is just a matter of did I give ample notice of the transaction or occurrences that gave rise to the claim. And that I did. And that's what the law requires. That's all that the law requires. The defense wants to institute code pleading, wants to take us back 7 years. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you very much. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. That ends our docket for this hour.